Lord Peter Wimsey. Starring Ian Carmichael as Lord Peter, with Carlton Hobbs as the judge, Charlotte Mitchell as the Dowager Duchess, and Anne Bell as Harriet Vane. Strong Poison by Dorothy L. Sayers. Adapted in 6 episodes by Chris Miller. Episode 1, Old Bailey.
I'm terribly afraid, Peter, that we are going to be too late to obtain seats.
Now, don't worry about that, Mother. Old Parker Bird has reserved some for us, and Freddy, our butler, has promised to keep him warm till we arrive.
Freddy, what's his interest in this trial?
Just curiosity, like everyone else. Murder is always fascinating, don't you know? And when it's the case of a young woman being accused of poisoning her lover, it becomes nothing short of sensational. Particularly when she admits to buying in large quantities of arsenic and produces such a dashed entertaining reason for doing so.
What reason precisely, dear?
Yes. Well, I don't want to spoil it for you, Mother. The judge is summing up today, so he'll be going through all the evidence. Incidentally, the case against the prisoner will be very convincing and watertight. The judge will be beastly hostile, and the jury will undoubtedly convict.
Very well, dear.
But one thing I can tell you for certain, Mother. Harriet Vane did not murder Philip Boys.
Just as you say, dear.
Members of the jury, you have listened with great patience to the evidence in this distressing case, and it is now my duty to sum up the facts and arguments which have been put before you so as to help you in forming your decision. The deceased Philip Boys was, as you have heard, a writer. And in the year 1927, he became acquainted with the prisoner Harriet Vane, who is also a novelist by profession. She has told us herself, with great candor, how she became deeply attached to Philip Boys, and how 8 months after meeting him, she consented to live on terms of intimacy with him outside the bonds of marriage. Now, you may feel, and quite properly, that this was a very wrong thing to do. You will not be led away by the false glamour which certain writers contrive to throw about free love into thinking that this was anything but an ordinary, vulgar act of misbehavior. Sir Impey Biggs, very rightly using all his great eloquence on behalf of his client, has spoken of Miss Vane's unselfish sacrifice and immolation. He will not, I am sure, pay too much attention to this. At any rate, Philip Boys and the prisoner lived together in this fashion for nearly a year, apparently on terms of the greatest mutual affection. Nevertheless, in February 1929, there was a quarrel, and the couple separated. One of the curious features of this case is the reason assigned for this quarrel. As to that, the only evidence we have is the prisoner's own, given, you will recall, during cross-examination by the Attorney General.
Now, Miss Vane, I would like, if I may, to take you back to that evening of February the 9th. Could you tell the court precisely what Mr. Boyce said to you after dinner?
He made a suggestion which I found intolerably patronizing and insulting.
And what was that?
He asked me to marry him.
Could you explain to the court, Miss Vane, why exactly you found a proposal of marriage so unwelcome?
Because he'd made a fool of me. I'd never wanted to live with him outside marriage. He persuaded me to do so against all the religious principles I'd been brought up on. I saw no reason why we shouldn't have been married from the start. But he told me he was totally opposed to formal marriage. And I believed him. But it was all just a test. He just wanted to see whether I would be as slavishly devoted to him as his vanity required. And when he saw I was, he was prepared to condescend to marry me. I felt utterly humiliated.
Surely that was not the sole cause of that evening's quarrel.
Yes, it was.
There must have been something else, some other grievance. He had been unfaithful to you, perhaps, or unkind.
No.
Very well. So, what was the upshot?
I packed up all my things the next morning and left his house for good. I stayed with a friend for a week or so and then took a small flat of my own in Doughty Street.
And did you see Mr. Boys again before he died?
Yes, once or twice at the houses of friends.
These assignations...
They weren't assignations. They were accidental encounters.
Very well, these accidental encounters. Various prosecution witnesses have testified that there were at least 3 such one at the end of March, another in the second week of April, and a third sometime in May. Is that correct?
They were informal gatherings, so I cannot swear to the dates, but I believe that is substantially correct, yes.
Did you speak to Mr. Boys on any of these occasions?
I was polite, but no more.
You still felt animosity towards him?
I was still very angry with him.
Angry enough to give him arsenic?
No! Not ever angry enough for that.
Well, members of the jury, that is for you to consider. Whether Philip Boyce's proposal of marriage could reasonably be construed as a motive for murder. But I must impress upon you that no other motive has been suggested in evidence. Let us now turn our attention to the question of the arsenic. On April the 10th, a young woman who has been identified as Harriet Dane entered a chemist's shop in Southampton Row and purchased 2 ounces of commercial arsenic, saying that she needed it to destroy rats. You will recall the prisoner's evidence concerning this transaction given during Sir Impey Biggs' examination in chief.
Miss Vane, did you in fact buy arsenic, as stated by witnesses, on April the 10th?
Yes, I did.
And what name did you sign in the poisons book?
Mary Slater.
Did you use the arsenic to destroy rats?
No.
Did you make any further purchases of arsenic?
Yes. On May the 5th, I bought a tin of arsenical weed killer from a different shop and gave the name Edith Waters.
Miss Vane, what is your profession?
I'm a novelist. I write detective stories.
Could you tell the court, Miss Vane, why you made these 2 purchases of arsenic?
Because at the time I was writing a novel about arsenic poisoning, and I wanted to prove by experiment how easy it is for an ordinary person to get hold of the stuff.
Please continue, Miss Vane.
There's a scene in the book where a young woman goes into a chemist's shop and buys a considerable quantity under a false name. I had to prove to myself that it was within the bounds of possibility.
Miss Vane, when did you get the idea for this story?
Last December. I discussed it at the time with Mr. Challoner, my literary agent.
Last December? So you were discussing plans for a novel which involved the surreptitious purchasing of arsenic some 2 months before your quarrel with Philip Boyce?
Yes.
Milord, at a later stage, I shall call Mr. Challoner to corroborate Miss Vane's evidence on this point.
That, then, members of the jury, is the prisoner's explanation of these purchases, and you must consider it for what it is worth. Now, about this time, Philip Boyce began to suffer from renewed attacks of a gastric trouble to which he had been subject for some years. There is, however, a coincidence of dates here which may be significant, for each of these attacks occurred within a day or so of his meeting Miss Vane. Indeed, in 2 cases, within a few days of Miss Vane's purchase of arsenic. At any rate, after the 3rd attack, Boyce was advised by his doctor to take a holiday. And he went to North Wales with a friend, Mr. Ryland Vaughan. According to Mr. Vaughan, Philip Boyce's health improved dramatically there, but he continued to fret about Harriet Vane. On June the 16th, he wrote to her, saying he would be back in town on the 20th and would like to see her to attempt a reconciliation. Miss Vane replied in a cold, almost hostile note that he could come round at 9:30 p.m. on the 20th if he wished, but she had no intention of changing her mind. Nevertheless, Philip Boyce came back to town on the afternoon of the 20th. We now come to the evening of that day, and I ask for your particular attention here, because it was undoubtedly in the course of this evening that the fatal dose of arsenic was administered. At 7:30, Mr. Boyce went round to have dinner with his cousin, Mr. Norman Urquhart, in whose house in Woburn Square, incidentally, he had gone to reside shortly after Miss Vane left him. The door was opened by Mr. Urquhart's maid, Hannah Westlock, and I would like to recall to you in detail Miss Westlock's evidence.
Miss Westlock, how did Mr. Boyce look to you when he arrived on the evening in question?
Oh, he looked very well, sir. Fitter than I'd seen him for months.
Can you tell the court where he went when he entered the house?
Yes, sir. He went straight up to his room, and about a quarter of an hour later he came down to the library for sherry.
Was Mr. Urquhart in the library then?
No, sir. He came in almost immediately after.
Carry on, Miss Westlock. Who poured the sherry?
I did, sir. I decanted a fresh bottle on the master's orders and poured the gentlemen out a glass each. They wasn't long about it and came into dinner shortly.
And where were you throughout dinner?
In the dining room, sir. Master likes me to be in attendance the whole time.
Very dignified custom. Could you now tell the court, Miss Westlock, what the gentlemen ate that evening?
Well, sir, they had clear soup, sir, followed by turbot with sauce, and then casserole chicken, sir, and finally a sweet omelette.
Did they finish all these dishes?
No, sir. The first three courses came back to the kitchen, and Mrs. Pettikin, that's the cook, and I, we finished them off for our supper.
And did you feel any ill effects after the meal?
No, sir.
Tell us about the sweet omelette, Miss Westlock. There was none of that left, you say?
No, sir, because it has to be eaten at once, sir. Mr. Urquhart's very particular about that, sir. So Mr. Boyce cooked it at the table in a chafing dish and then divided it into two portions, one for himself and one for the master, sir.
And you say Mr. Boyce cooked it?
Yes, sir.
And did they both eat their portions?
Oh, yes, sir.
Was there anything at all at the table which Mr. Boyce partook of alone?
Yes, sir. There was a bottle of Burgundy. Mr. Urquhart don't drink at meals now, but Mr. Boyce had a couple of glasses, and afterwards I caught the bottle up, sir.
Thank you, Miss Westlock. Millard, I shall be calling Sir James Lubbock later to testify that the contents of that bottle were fortunately preserved and were later analysed and found to be harmless.
So you see, members of the jury, every article of diet except the wine was partaken of by two people at least, and in most cases by four. And neither Mr. Urquhart, Miss Westlock, nor Mrs. Pettikin felt any ill effects. This brings us to 9 o'clock. After dinner, coffee was ordered, but Boyce excused himself on the ground that he would probably be given coffee by Harriet Vane. At 9:15, he left Woburn Square and took a taxi the half mile or so to Doughty Street. He arrived at 9:25, and Miss Vane let him in immediately. Now, as the interview was naturally a private one, we have no account of it to go upon, but that of the prisoner. You will remember what she said in cross-examination?
Well, as I said, as soon as he'd come in and I'd closed the door, I offered him a cup of coffee. He said he'd love some, so I poured out 2 cups. He didn't take milk or sugar, and nor do I.
I see. Miss Vane, could you tell the court where the coffee was standing?
It was in a saucepan, the saucepan I'd made it in.
Miss Vane, I have here a copy of a statement you made to Chief Inspector Parker on September the 30th. In it you say, and I quote, I had a cup of coffee ready for him on his arrival. Did you have a cup of coffee ready?
Not in a cup. No, the coffee was in the saucepan, as I said.
Then why did you say in your statement that the coffee was in a cup?
I didn't. I said I had a cup of coffee ready, meaning a certain quantity of coffee.
Is that a normal expression amongst the bohemians of Bloomsbury?
Millard, I object to my learned friend's sneering tone.
Thank you, Sir MP. Mr. Attorney, could you possibly phrase your question less tendentiously?
As your lordship pleases. Miss Vane, is a cup of coffee, meaning a certain quantity of coffee, a normal expression?
It is to me, yes.
Thank you, Miss Vane.
Well, members of the jury, whether that phrase is normal usage is something you will be able to judge for yourselves. But I hardly need point out how damaging to Miss Vane's case any suggestion that the cup had been prepared in advance would be. Be that as it may, according to the prisoner's evidence, the interview was not a satisfactory one, and at 10 o'clock the deceased expressed his intention of leaving her. She says that he appeared uneasy and remarked that he was not feeling well, adding that her behavior had greatly upset him. At 10 minutes past 10, that is a full 10 minutes later, and I would like you to make a particular note of that, the taxi driver Burke, who was standing on the rank in Guildford Street, was approached by Philip Boyce and told to take him to Woburn Square. When the taxi stopped before Mr. Urquhart's house, Boyce did not get out. And on opening the door to investigate, Burke found him huddled in the corner in agony. He was helped into the house, and as this attack appeared to be much more serious than usual, Mr. Urquhart summoned Dr. Weir by telephone. Before the doctor's arrival, the patient vomited violently and thereafter continued to vomit persistently. Dr. Weir diagnosed the trouble as acute gastritis and made up a soothing medicine to control the vomiting, but this unfortunately had little effect. The next morning, the patient's condition had deteriorated to such an extent that a nurse was called in. On the 22nd, he became weaker and lost consciousness and at 3 o'clock on the morning of June the 23rd, he died. I will now adjourn the court for lunch.
Roast beef for you, Mother?
Very nice.
Well, I'll have the same. There's two roast beefs, waiter.
Oh.
Ready?
Oh, I don't know. He would adjourn just at the beastliest moment when everybody's appetite is thoroughly taken away.
Oh, excuse me a moment, Mother. There's Biggie. Must just have a word with him.
Yes, well, you run along, dear, and give Sir Impey my regards.
He's right here.
Yes.
Gone to put an alternative theory of some kind, I expect.
I expect so.
Top hole to see old Whimsy back, ain't it? Wonderful how keen he is on this sort of thing, don't you know? Regularly up to his eyes, isn't it?
Yes, well, you see, it's one of the Chief Inspector Parker's cases, and they're such great friends, you know. Wasn't that Peter's Miss Climpson on the jury?
Who?
Miss Climpson, the elderly spinster who looks as if she stepped out of a magazine of the 90s.
Oh, yes, ain't she the one who runs that comic charity stunt of Whimsy's for him?
Oh, yes, yes. Such a good thing to answer in all those shady advertisements and then getting the people shown up. Ah, he has Peter.
I'm frankly sorry to disappear like that, Mater, but I had to say a word to Biggie. He's having a rotten time. And that old Jeffries of a judge looks as though he was getting measured for the black cap. Confound the fellow for not reading out that letter again.
What letter, Whimsy?
The one Boys wrote to Miss Vane from North Wales. Biggie made a lot of it in his closing speech yesterday. It was full of self-pity. Life is an utter mess-up. I can't stick it out here any longer. If I can't make you see this thing in the right perspective this time, I'll chuck it for good. I've decided to cut adrift and take a trip out west. That sort of thing, you know. Biggie argued that it strongly suggested Boys was thinking of suicide.
Yes, but if it was suicide, when did he take the arsenic, dear?
Well, what about those 10 minutes between leaving Miss Vane and hiring the cab? If he'd taken it in liquid form, he'd have been getting the jolly old symptoms in a quarter of an hour.
You've been reading up the subject, Peter.
Yes. Dangerous to know too much about poisons, what? Look at the trouble it landed Miss Vane in. Be thou as chaste as ice, as pure as snow, thou shalt not escape the Old Bailey.
Members of the jury, Philip Boys died at 3 a.m. on the 23rd of June this year. Dr. Weir issued a death certificate stating that the cause of death was acute gastritis, and the funeral took place on the 28th of the same month. Up to this time, of course, no suspicion of any kind had been aroused. However, during the month of August, the nurse who had been called in 2 days before Boys died, Nurse Williams, went to look after another friend of Ryland Vaughan's. Mr. Vaughan, you recall, was the gentleman who accompanied Boys to North Wales. Rather indiscreetly, you may think, Nurse Williams spoke about Philip Boys to her new patient, saying that in her opinion, his illness had looked very much like poisoning, and even mentioning the word arsenic. This quickly got to the ears of Mr. Vaughan. Now, Mr. Vaughan had been greatly distressed and surprised by Philip Boyce's death after his immense improvement on holiday. In addition, he felt that Harriet Vane had behaved badly, not only about the love affair, but particularly in not even attending the funeral. He therefore went to Dr. Weir and asked his opinion. Dr. Weir, while naturally upset to hear of any suggestion of poisoning, nevertheless had to admit that the symptoms of arsenical poisoning and acute gastritis are really indistinguishable. On hearing this, Mr. Vaughan at once wrote to Philip Boyce's father, suggesting an inquiry. And as you have heard, eventually the police were communicated with and an exhumation order obtained. We now come to the evidence of the distinguished analyst, Sir James Lubbock.
Sir James, did you analyze the body of Philip Boyce for arsenic?
I did.
Could you tell the court what this involved?
Certainly. My colleague and I took certain organs of the body, the stomach, intestines, kidneys, liver, and so on, and first of all subjected small portions of them to Marsh's test for arsenic, which indicated that they all contained the element. Having established that arsenic was present, we then undertook a series of quantitative analyses and calculated from our results an approximate figure for the total weight of arsenic in the body. We then allowed for the amount of arsenic eliminated from the body.
How was that done?
Oh, arsenic passes through the body extremely quickly under normal conditions, especially if taken with food or immediately following a meal, because the arsenic irritates the lining of the internal organs and speeds up the process of elimination. In this case, there was additional elimination through vomiting. We came to the conclusion that a large and fatal dose of arsenic, 4 or 5 grains perhaps, had been taken about 3 days before death.
Did you test the hair and fingernails for arsenic?
We did.
Did you find arsenic present?
Yes.
More than in the hair of a normal, healthy person?
Considerably more.
How far along the hair did you find arsenic?
About 1/2 inch.
And what, in your opinion, does this indicate?
That the deceased had taken arsenic at least 3 months before his death.
Thank you, Sir James.
And you will have to decide, members of the jury, what importance is to be attached to that evidence in view of the prisoner's purchase of arsenic in April and May and the deceased's attacks of sickness in March, April and May. There is just one more point for us to consider. It has been suggested by the defense that Philip Boyce may have taken the arsenic himself after leaving Harriet Vane's flat. And they bring forward books which show that the onset of symptoms can take place in a very short time after taking the arsenic. As little as 1/4 hour if the arsenic is in liquid form. You must therefore ask yourselves whether, after leaving Miss Vane's, Philip Boyce went to some quiet spot and took a dose of arsenic, which he must in that case have brought with him in anticipation of an unfavorable interview. But I must remind you here that the defense have brought no evidence to show that Philip Boyce ever bought any arsenic or had access to any. Well, I think that is the case as it is presented to you. This woman is charged with having murdered her former lover by arsenic. He undoubtedly did take arsenic, and if you are satisfied that she gave it to him with intent to injure or kill him, and that he died of it, then it is your duty to find her guilty of murder. Sir Impey Biggs, in his able and eloquent speech, has put it to you that she had very little motive for such a murder. But I am bound to tell you that murders are very often committed for what seem to be the most inadequate motives, if indeed any motive can be called adequate for such a crime. The prisoner had the means, the arsenic, the expert knowledge, and the opportunity to administer it. If you feel that there is any reasonable doubt that the prisoner gave this poison to Philip Boyce deliberately, you must bring her in not guilty of murder. You are not bound to decide how it was given, if it was not given by her. Consider the circumstances of the case as a whole, and say what conclusion you have come to.
All wrong. We don't really mean that, Whimsy.
I do.
But, I mean, dash it, where's the flaw in it?
There isn't one. It's damnably knife-proof. There's nothing wrong about it at all. Except that the girl's innocent.
You're turning into a common or garden psychologist, isn't he, Duchess?
No, oh, I wish I had known that girl. So interesting. A really remarkable face. Perhaps not strictly good-looking, and all the more interesting for that, because good-looking people are so often cows. I read one of her books recently, you know, really quite good and so well-written, and I didn't guess the murderer till page 200, rather clever, because I usually do about page 15. So very curious. To write books about crimes and then be accused of a crime oneself, some people might say it was a judgment. I wonder whether, if she didn't do it, she has spotted the murderer herself. Well, I suppose we shall soon know now, not the truth, necessarily, but what the jury have made of it.
It can't be long. I'm giving them 20 minutes. I say, Whimsy, did she really not do it?
Ah, I have locked my heart in a silver box and pinned it with a golden pin. Nobody's opinion matters now except the jury's. I expect Miss Kimpson is telling them all about it. And when once she starts, she doesn't stop for an hour or two. She has a militant high church conscience of remarkable staying power. and a person who can believe in all the articles of the Christian faith ain't going to boggle over a trifle of adverse evidence. Go and have dinner, Freddy Old Bean, or go to sleep or something. Nothing's going to happen for ages. Not for ages. Wake up, Freddy. Come in, my own, my sweet. Were it never so airy a tread.
What? Good Lord! He'd been out 5 hours. Look at their faces.
Yes, they say if it's going to be guilty, they never look at the prisoner.
And they're all looking at the floor, except Miss Kimpson. Are you wrong, Whimsy? Sorry, old man.
Members of the jury, have you all agreed upon your verdict?
I'm sorry to say that we find it impossible to come to an agreement.
Do you think that with a little more time you may be able to reach an agreement?
I'm afraid not, my lord. I see no prospect at all of our ever agreeing.
Can I assist you in any way?
No, thank you, my lord. We quite understand the evidence, but we cannot agree about it.
You're quite sure? I do not wish to hurry you in any way. I'm quite prepared to wait here as long as you like.
We shall never agree, my lord. Not if we were to stay here till doomsday.
That is very unfortunate. But in that case, of course, there is nothing for it but to discharge you and order a fresh trial.
Oh, good old Miss Clemson. She's done it. Oh, good egg. Excellent, excellent egg. We've got another chance.
In that episode of Strong Poison, the parts were played as follows. Lord Peter Whimsy, Ian Carmichael, the judge, Carlton Hobbs, the Dowager Duchess, Charlotte Mitchell, Harriet Vane, Anne Bell, Attorney General, Stephen Thorne, Sir Impey Biggs, Robert Gillespie, Sir James Lubbock, Gerard Green, Freddie Arbuthnot, Christopher Schooler, Hannah Westlock, Christine O'Zan, Foreman of the Jury, Clifford Norgate. Old Bailey was adapted by Chris Miller from the book Strong Poison by Dorothy L. Sayers. The programme was produced by Simon Brett.